The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Greg Cockcroft from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is The Atlantic. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from The Atlantic magazine. And our first article today is entitled, A Classic Childhood Pastime is Fading. Kids on bikes once filled the streets, not anymore. And this was written by Aaron Sagan. Walk down a quiet American street a few decades ago, and chances were good that you'd come across a vision of a Spielbergian sort, a gaggle of school-aged children charging down the block on bikes, armed with a steely sense of purpose, and without any protective headwear. You're less likely to catch that kind of scene today. Over the course of the 1990s, an average of 20.5 million children ages 7 to 17 hopped on a bike six or more times a year, according to data from the National Sporting Goods Association, a sports equipment trade group. Only a few decades later, that number has fallen by nearly half to about 10.9 million in 2023. Of those kids, according to the association, just less than 5% rode their bikes frequently. With this decline, kids are losing more than the potential mode of transport. Biking supports children's independence and overall health in a way that many activities cannot. It's a great way to get moving and build strength, and can improve coordination and balance. Like many types of fitness, it can help reduce children's future chances of cardiovascular disease and diabetes. But compared with some of the other ways that children get exercise, such as team sports, it's much more affordable, especially if you buy a used bike. And, crucially, once kids are trained, doesn't require much from adults. The thought of their kids traveling solo might get some parents wringing their hands, and for good reason. Biking can be risky, and finding an appropriate place to practice can be tricky in the city or in the suburbs. But if parents can find safe environments for teaching their children to navigate streets confidently on their own, the amount of freedom those kids will gain is invaluable. On a bike, a child gets to choose where to go, how to get there, without having to check in with a parent, which lets them practice making decisions. As they ride more, the activity can even start to rewire their brain, helping them form spatial maps of their neighborhood and develop the kind of competence and knowledge that can seed lasting resilience and self-esteem. Kids aren't the only ones who benefit when they start getting around on two wheels. When enough children bike or simply get outside, whole neighborhoods can be transformed. Research has shown that when children play in the open, whether they're riding a bike, kicking a ball, or merely puttering, parents feel more of a connection to their neighbors, and many people begin to feel safer. As fewer kids venture out, however, neighborhoods can lose those social ties. Many people blame smartphones for this trend, but as Esther Walker, the research leader at the nonprofit youth cycling organization Outride, told me, I've never read or heard a student say they would just prefer to be on their phone. Kids do want to bike, Nancy Pullen-Sufert, the director of the government-funded program, the National Center for Safe Routes to School, told me. But conditions on many streets don't exactly inspire confidence. Walker regularly speaks with middle schoolers in Outrides programs, and she told me that although they crave mobility, many also say that the traffic in their neighborhood makes riding too dangerous, or that their parents won't let them go on their own. In many places, this fear is well-founded. American roadways have gotten faster and busier. Since the 1990s, speed limits have ticked upward. Each year, minus a few temporary dips, drivers have progressively clocked more collective miles and driven ever larger cars. According to a 2023 report by the nonprofit Insurance Institute for Highway Safety, Over the past 30 years, the average U.S. passenger vehicle has gotten about 4 inches wider, 10 inches longer, 8 inches taller, and 1,000 pounds heavier. These machines may be protecting drivers and passengers, but they can be much more intimidating to people on bikes. The annual number of children killed on bikes has actually fallen, a 2021 CDC report found, but the report acknowledges that this is likely in part because fewer kids are out riding. The decrease in kids' deaths seems reflective not of streets safety. An SUV, the most dominant car in the U.S. market, is 8 times more likely than a sedan to kill a child, but rather of parents' understanding of the danger that big cars pose. Families haven't always had to be this vigilant. Children in previous decades may not have had designated bike lanes, complete sidewalks, or other protective features now common on many American roads, but they had more space to wander, fewer and slower cars to contend with, and safety in numbers as throngs of children dependently roamed about the neighborhood. It wasn't until public planning began to prioritize cars that children lost not only areas to play, but also the freedom to get places on their own. Tellingly, the share of kindergarten through eighth grade students walking or biking to school fell from 48% in 1969 to just 13% in 2009, according to a 2011 report prepared by the National Center for Safe Routes to School. By adding more bike-friendly infrastructure, lower traffic speeds, separated bike lanes, calmer intersections, local governments could encourage children and other residents to start riding again. In the interim, teaching children how to share the road with drivers is mostly up to caregivers. Finding safe enough spots for practice might be tough in some cities, but with a little creativity, parents can track down dead ends, streets closed to cars, unused parking lots, or parks with paved pathways to let their kids spread out and find their bearings in relatively calm surroundings. Putting in that work may demand more of parents in the short term. But as a mom whose 9-year-old recently began riding, I would argue that the investment of time and attention is worth it. In my reporting, I've heard over and over from parents about how desperately they want to raise confident and resilient kids. Many opt for a packed calendar of extracurriculars, most of which require an adult to act as chauffeur and supervisor. Yet kids don't tend to flourish when they're being shuttled around and monitored by adults. What many need is a bit more freedom, time to do as they please, to pedal aimlessly, until one day they're ready to take off. Our second story, Ukraine's warning to the world's other military forces. Expensive planes, tanks, and ships can be destroyed on the cheap. This is written by Phillips Payson O'Brien. Relying on its own resources, Ukraine has just carried out what might be the most complex, elaborately planned, and cost-effective military operation of its current war with Russia. Recently, the Ukrainians used drones to attack, almost simultaneously, at least 4 Russian airfields separated by thousands of miles. Among them were 2 airfields just inside Russia, but the targets also included Olena Air Base above the Arctic Circle and, remarkably, Balaya Air Base in Siberia, which lies just over the border from Mongolia. The attack showed how much audacity, ingenuity, and effectiveness the Ukrainians can bring to their own defense when Western leaders aren't pressuring them to hold back. It also revealed the vulnerability of the large, expensive planes and other hardware treasured by major powers around the world. Images circulating immediately after the attacks appeared to show that Russian aircraft had been hit with remarkable accuracy at some of their most vulnerable points. The Ukrainians seem to have placed relatively small drone swarms in cavities built into the top of trailer trucks, Then, when the trucks were close to the targets, the trailer roofs opened up and the swarms of drones flew out, surprising and overwhelming Russian defenses. Even how the drones themselves were operated represents something notable. In many cases, they seem to have been flying courses pre-programmed via the open-source software ArduPilot, which has proved effective in navigating unmanned aerial vehicles for hundreds of miles and precisely reaching targets. Although details remain limited, the operation testifies to how rapidly drone technology is evolving. Human operators might well have been observing some of the flights and have been in a position to take control if necessary, but some of the vehicles may have operated outside of human authority, flying pre-programmed courses. Ukrainian officials have said that some of the drones were basically AI trained to recognize the most vulnerable parts of Russian aircraft and automatically home in on those areas. The Ukrainians have claimed that more than 40 advanced Russian aircraft were hit and that at least 13 were destroyed. How much of the damage is reparable is not yet clear. Kyiv boasted of destroying more than a third of Russia's large Tu-95 bombers, which have been a primary launch system for the large volleys of missiles that regularly strike Ukrainian cities. The Tu-95s are literally irreplaceable. Russia has no production facilities making more of these aircraft, and it has not yet designed a successor to the model. The attack also appears to have damaged a large number of Tu-22 M3 bombers and probably one A-50 command aircraft, the Russian equivalent of a U.S.-made airborne warning and control aircraft. The total cost of Russian losses likely runs into several billion dollars. In contrast, the cost of one of the Ukrainian drones used in the attack has been estimated at about $1,200, so that even if the airfields were attacked with 100 drones each, a seemingly high estimate, the total cost of the drones used would have been less than $1 million. I struggle to think of a recent military operation where one side suffered so much damage at so little cost to the other. In one sense, the Ukrainian attack represents a culmination of what we have seen happen since Russia launched its full-scale invasion in 2022. Seemingly outmatched by Russia's much larger military, Ukraine has used drones and other improvised equipment to destroy tanks, large warships, bombers, and other large legacy systems. Military planners and many outside commentators have been too slow to acknowledge the significance of Ukraine's defensive tactics. But the most recent attacks plainly show the need for major changes in how all militaries are constructed and trained. For the United States and other major Western militaries, Ukraine's use of trucks parked outside secure areas near military sites will pose uncomfortable questions. How closely do they, or can they, monitor all the truck traffic that streams past their bases? Do they know what happens in every nearby property from which an adversary could hide drone swarms and then launch them with no warning? For many years now, for instance, Chinese interests have been buying large amounts of farmland right next to important U.S. military bases. They could be growing soybeans, but they could also be staging grounds for drone swarms that could make the Ukrainian attacks look minuscule. Meanwhile, in Europe, military bases in the past few years been regularly overflown by large numbers of unknown drones, which are presumably gathering intelligence. Whichever power is responsible obviously has the ability to deploy a larger number of drones in kinetic attacks. The Ukrainians are showing U.S. and European militaries that better security against drone flights is long overdue. For Ukraine's doubters, these attacks should lead to a period of quiet reflection. President Donald Trump has insisted that Ukraine has, quote, no cards, end quote. The New York Times editorial board recently implied that Ukraine is unlikely to produce a military breakthrough that can change the basic course of the war. But pessimism about Ukraine's capabilities is ahistorical and wrong-headed. For 3 years, the Biden administration simultaneously supported Ukraine and discouraged major attacks on Russian soil for fear of provoking Vladimir Putin too much. That constraint no longer exists now that Trump has written off Ukraine and appears eager to end the war on Putin's terms. Until now, Ukraine has had only a limited ability to launch attacks as ambitious as the one it just executed. If Ukraine's remaining allies help arm it properly to undertake similar operations at scale, it can still win the war. Now our third article, What Introverts and Extroverts Can Do to Get Happier, by Arthur C. Brooks. A year before the pandemic changed all of our lives, a friend sent me a link to a survey based on academic research that rates your personality traits on a numeric scale. He was particularly keen to know my extroversion score to see if the test was accurate. His results had shown that he scored at the 15th percentile. He sent it to me as the most extroverted person he knows. Sure enough, I scored at the 96th percentile. "Lucky you," he remarked. "Extroverts are a lot happier." He was right about that, on average. Decades of research have consistently shown that extroverts have a significant happiness edge over introverts. They report higher levels of general well-being, as well as more frequent moments of joy. COVID-19, however, has given us extroverts our comeuppance. Research published in March in the scientific journal PLOS-1 studied the impact of the pandemic on people with various personality characteristics. The authors found that mood worsened for extroverts, but improved for introverts. As my friend said, only half jokingly, "Why don't we just stay locked down forever?" In ordinary times, American introverts are like cats living in dogland, underappreciated, uncomfortable, and slightly out of place. A side effect of shutting down the world was to turn it into catland, at least for a little while. That gave the introverts a chance to lord it over their solitary comfort over the rest of us, for once. To this, I say, woof. But the temporary shift has also created a kind of social science field experiment highlighting all the ways in which introverts and extroverts can learn from each other. If we take the lessons to heart, we can all benefit. Psychologists see extroversion as one of the big five personality traits, along with agreeableness, openness, conscientiousness, and neuroticism. The Big Five theory has been a staple of psychology since the 1980s, but the introvert-extrovert binary was first popularized in 1921 by the Swiss psychiatrist Carl Jung, who posited that the two groups have different primary life goals. The former, he thought, seek to establish autonomy and independence. The latter seek union with others. These stereotypes have persisted to this day. The German-born psychologist Hans Eysenck further developed Jung's theory in the 1960s, arguing that our genetics determine our relative extroversion. He believed that cortical arousal, that is, the brain's level of alertness, was more difficult for extroverts than introverts, so the former seeks stimulation in the company of others, ideally the fresh company of new people. Subsequent research has shown mixed results on Eysenck's specific theory, but has found clear cognitive differences between the groups. One common explanation for the happiness differential between introverts and extroverts follows from stereotypes like Jung and Eysenck's. Humans are inherently social animals, so contact brings happiness. Extroverts seek out contact, so extroverts are happier. The fact that introverts prefer solitude and often struggle with sociability doesn't mean that avoiding contact makes them happier. It just means they prefer something that makes them unhappy. Nothing strange here. If you can also prefer unhealthy food. There are complementary cultural explanations for the happiness differential. To begin with, extroversion is highly rewarded in American society and predicts a significant edge in earning power. On average, extroverts make about $12,000 more per year than introverts. Extroverts attain other advantages in the workplace as well, such as promotions to leadership, positions, and high performance evaluations. Some resent these patterns and believe they show a lack of cultural depth. In her book, Quiet, The Power of Introverts in a World That Can't Stop Talking, Susan Cain lists the many advances made by introverts, from the theory of gravity to Google, and argues that admiring and rewarding extroversion is not just unfair, but hinders progress. If you ever feel disillusioned by Americans' habits of elevating egotistical yet charismatic leaders, you might have to admit that Cain has a point. Whether we are introverts or extroverts, we don't need to regret our journey, sojourn to Catland, or dread the return to Dogland. On the contrary, each group can teach the other a lesson that can improve all of our well-being. 1. Introverts should focus more on the future, like extroverts do. In 2001, a group of Oxford scholars broke a sample of survey respondents into four groups: happy extroverts, unhappy extroverts, happy introverts, and unhappy introverts. As expected, the happy extroverts outnumbered the happy introverts by about 2-1. But the researchers were more interested in what drove the rare happy introverts' relatively high well-being. They found the same characteristics among both happy groups: optimism, a sense of life purpose, and self-esteem. Extroverts, of course, love to talk to others about the future, their dreams, their life's purpose. As psychologists have long shown, we tend to act according to the commitments we have articulated to others. So the extrovert habit of telling everyone you meet about your goals makes you more likely to reach them and therefore get happier. Happy introverts have figured out how to envision the future without all the, uncomfortable for them, personal sharing with lots of people. They tend to have close one-on-one friendships instead, where they can share their dreams if and when they choose. 2. Extroverts should work on deep friendships, which introverts tend to have more of. Intimate friendships are not only good for sharing your dreams, they are also a clear and direct producer of happiness. In particular, forging close friendships with people from whom you have nothing to gain is an intense source of satisfaction. But doing so isn't easy, especially for extroverts, because of their love of crowds, audiences, fresh contact, and excitement. The pandemic's pause in life's rhythm has left society's dogs in a state of social withdrawal, explaining the current happiness inversion. But it also presents an opportunity for extroverts to cultivate more real friendships like introverts have. While this might not be the natural tendency, research shows that extroverts tend to have a lot of low-depth friendships with other extroverts. It is more optimal for happiness. Extroverts should set a goal for the next few weeks and months to deepen one friendship before life returns to normal. If they don't know how to begin, they should just watch a happy introvert do it. I am a dog, but my 18-year-old daughter is a cat. She and her closest cat friend talk for an hour or two every day, making a point to update each other on their life plans. Find your nearest happy cats and act like them. beyond the specifics of introversion and extroversion, there is one important lesson in all this. Watching and learning from people very different from you is a great way to learn to be happier. Indeed, a love of human diversity of all types, from culture to character to politics, is required for a full education in well-being. None of us has a lock on the best practices, and surrounding ourselves with people just like us will not inspire new ideas to raise our life satisfaction. For the happiest world, we need cats and dogs together. And next, a Dear James letter by James Parker. Dear James, I'm only 19 years old and I'm afraid of dying alone. Any advice? Dear reader, first of all, you are not only 19 years old. 19 is a perfectly respectable age at which to be experiencing the terror of the human condition, especially these days. My own encounter with dizzying finitude didn't happen till I was 25, but this was pre-internet, pre-authoritarian disruption. Your generation, I think, has aged at warp speed. By the time you're 16, you're all anxiety ninjas and grandmasters of depression. From your question, I can't tell if it's the eventual snuffing out of your subjectivity that so appalls you or the idea of having no one there when it happens. Probably some combination of the two, right? We go through this life sealed up in our skull, squinting out through our jaundiced little eye holes, and we're lucky if we feel the consoling touch of another. If we get shaken all night long, as AC/DC has it, before our switch gets randomly flicked to the off position. Dying alone, that's what it comes down to. Or does it? Because the older I get and the weirder I get, the more convinced I become that, far from being a bunch of brain spinning in cosmic isolation, we are wildly and unstoppably connected to one another, to the world, to everything. Our bodies are crucibles of sensation. Our minds go out to greet reality, and other people, whether we like it or not, are all over us, just as we are all over them. Your life and its decisions are your own. You're the boss. This is the flip side of isolation, autonomy. So claim it. Get out there. Revel in experience. Do the things you'll be proud of. Make the leap, and people will show up for you, I promise. Are we floating in a universal sea of love? I think we sort of are, especially when it doesn't feel like it. As a friend in London once said when he saw me despairing, be strong, mate. Be happy. We've run out of time for today's episode of The Atlantic. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The Atlantic is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.